Hey, everybody, welcome back to another Monday, the best night of the week. That means it's time for RFRX. I'm your host, Kara, and I have with me here our most bestest specialist psychicist sidekick, Helen Green. How are you?
Good. How are you doing, Kara? It's Monday.
It's Monday, my favorite day. What have you been up to lately?
Well, I missed last week because I was in New Hampshire visiting my family. So that was really nice. Yeah. I got to see my mama, my daddy, and I ate a lot of food and drank a lot of wine and hung out with my family members. It was really nice. So, but I'm back.
Excellent. And yeah. We missed you.
Thanks.
Glad you got to hang out with them, though. That sounds lovely.
Yeah. So how you doing, Kara?
I am doing well. I am still out and about for work, but I've got Mondays available to keep having it be the best night of the week, even though I'm in a different time zone. So I'll take it. Speaking of different time zones, I'm super excited about our guest this evening, who's joining us from halfway around the world. So looking forward to it. I guess we should go ahead and get started. What do you say, Helen?
I am in it to win it.
Yes. Okay, let's do it. Well, I am super excited to introduce our guest this evening. Richard Gilver has been having discussions with religious people for 30 years, originally talking to them in the street, then on internet message boards, and more recently on social media. He has studied Buddhist meditation for 2 decades and took an academic interest in religious scriptures, specifically from Buddhism, Islam, and Christianity around a decade ago. He began as a skeptic educator around 2 years ago, like many others, taking the opportunity during the beginning of the COVID pandemic to find a new way of communicating with people. And it was around that same time that he began volunteering with the ACA and undertook his degree in religion, philosophy, and ethics, a move encouraged by his wife to formalize his lifelong interest. And today he has his own skeptic show on YouTube, which looks at different topics with a heavy focus on academia, as well as he's the co-founder and co-host of the weekly Skeptic Hangout podcast and a host on the ACA's nonprofit show. And he has also appeared on several other shows, including being a host on Ethan Michael's The Perspective, International Freethinkers, We Are Parents, and a guest host on Truth Wanted and Talk Heathen. Also shows produced by the Atheist Community of Austin. And we're not done yet. He has also been a regular guest host on the Bloody Good Film Podcast, a weekly podcast that discusses action and horror movies, which, even though it is not technically about skepticism or anything to do with religion, we may have to pick your brain about that too. So just get ready for that. So Richard, welcome. Thank you for being here.
I am very, very happy to be here. My friend Helen Green, who you may know, suggested that I may come on here. And I was like, I said yes before the words actually left my mouth. I was that excited about it.
Yes. And I was so excited too. It's just, yeah, we were joking around about we had to twist your arm, and we were like, no, that's actually not what happened. you said, yes, I want to come on. And I said, yes, I want to have him on. And that was it.
That was it. Our, yeah.
Our lengthy negotiations for making this episode happen. So we are super excited, and I want to hear all about all of the things. So you are a man of eclectic and varied tastes, Richard. Tell us, how did you get involved in all of these different projects and podcasts?
That's the podcasting. I have no idea about technology, by the way. I'll just put that out there before we even begin. I like many people, I've been talking to people for a long, long, long time, and I've been through the kind of street epistemology before it was a thing. When I was about 13 or 14 years old and going into, you know, the city center on a Saturday afternoon, seeing all these religious people giving their opinions on the street and with the little stalls and things they'd have out, and I'd talk to them. And it's essentially, in a very basic form, when you're 13 or 14 year old, ask them what they believed and why in a very rudimentary way. And I've always been interested, you know, I'm in my mid-40s now, so it's a long time ago. I've always been interested in why people believe what they believe. And, you know, I went through when the internet first came along, or when I first got access to the internet, which was a bit after the internet first came along, as the joined message boards and things like that, and as you do. And then I got married, the internet progressed. It went from message boards to kind of social media, carried on those conversations. And then we were hit by the pandemic, and I'd previously found the ACA through YouTube. And I was liking what they were saying at the time on the host they had on there. And I was kind of, I think I'd already started volunteering with the ACA as a Facebook moderator. And I was toying with the idea of, you know, does anybody want to listen to anything I've got to say at all? And shall I start my own show? And there were a couple of other content creators who'd started just before me, and they kind of, they'd set up what they were doing, and it was very basic and very rudimentary, but I was loving what they were saying. And I thought, well, they clearly have no technical savvy either, and they're doing it, so I'm sure I can as well. And I contacted two of these content creators, and we actually started a podcast together. So yeah, it all started kind of around the beginning of the pandemic, and then I got more involved with the ACA, doing more and more things with them. Eventually became a host on the nonprofits, which I absolutely love, and we have some great hosts on there and some great guest speakers on there as well. And yeah, it kind of all went from there.
Yeah, and we are definitely going to be sharing the links to all of these things in the chat and in the show notes as well. So a couple of people have been asking in the chat. So we're going to do that for sure. But okay, so I know you've probably talked about this a million times, but for our listeners who are perhaps not familiar with your work and your background, how did all this start? You mentioned you had an interest from a young age in talking to people about what they believed in and why. What sparked that for you? Were you particularly religious when you were younger? How did you get that that interest?
I've never been a religious person as such. I've been in a unique position where over the years I've been a regular visitor to mosques. I've been a regular visitor to churches and Buddhist monasteries. So I've got a lot of friends who were. I remember one morning I was at work, and I start work really early. It's like 6 o'clock in the six o'clock in the morning, and I just started work, and I got a phone call from a Buddhist monk. From one of the monasteries, and it was just like it kind of blew my mind a little bit that had happened, and I had all these people around me who were working with me saying, "What just happened there? Why did you just get a phone call from a monk?" So yeah, it's a but what was the question? I've distracted myself with my little story.
All good. Yeah, I was just wondering what initially sparked your interest in talking with people about their religious beliefs, and what kind of beliefs you started with.
Yeah, I don't know what sparked my interest. I think when I was really young, I had like a lot of kids growing up in the 80s, when like with movies like Ghostbusters and things, I think everybody automatically, and I think a lot of people in Britain still do, hold some kind of supernatural belief like that, without really thinking about it, like beliefs in ghosts and, you know, alien visitations to Earth and weird stuff like that. And I think I held those kinds of belief without really thinking too much about it. And then as I started kind of getting past 10, which I think is the age you should drop those kinds of beliefs, I started kind of coming out of that thing. And then, like, as I said, meeting religious people was really the thing that, like, inspired me to start thinking about it critically, because that's really when things didn't start making sense.
Okay, so you were then interested in hearing from other people what was causing them to continue in these beliefs or not,
yeah,
as it were. And so how did that influence you as you had those conversations? Do you feel like that sent you on a particular trajectory or changed your thinking at all?
it changed me thinking. I do a lot of, I don't know what the technical term is, I do a lot of self-thinking. I think everybody does self-thinking. That's a particular. But like really, really deep introspection regarding questions, rather than just like having a conversation and kind of being satisfied with a yes or no answer. I kind of mulled everything over. And like each conversation I had, I wanted to kind of go into myself and kind of really think it through, rather than just being satisfied with a simple answer. Ask myself, you know, is there anything to this? Is this possible?
Yeah. No, that's interesting. And so at some point this morphed into a decision to formally study religious beliefs. Is that right?
Yeah. I mean, that was a long time after. I was about. It was a weird progression because I got into meditation. I got into Buddhist meditation through martial arts, and so I had no interest. I didn't really connect at that point the meditation with religion. I had an interest in religion and I had this kind of other interest, but it was more martial arts based at the start. It was more just about, you know, kind of relaxing myself and getting myself prepared from that perspective. And I don't know how long I'd been kind of doing martial arts when my teacher kind of, I was doing Chinese martial arts and the inner side of it, the soft side of it, is as important as the hard side of it. So, and my teacher noticed that I was interested in the kind of softer side of things as well, and the introspection. And so he kind of recommended it was a Chan teacher, but that's a Chinese form of Zen. Chan is the Chinese name for Zen. And he recommended that I go and see this meditation teacher from China. And I kind of did that when I very first began meditation. It was very kind of traditional Chinese one master, one student thing. And it was harsh. You know, I'd get a slap around the side of the head if I got the answer to a question wrong, harsh. You know, it was very much the kind of Mr.
That
Miyagi.
That doesn't sound very Zen.
No.
That doesn't sound Zen at all.
Yeah. It was great. I enjoyed it. It was a lot easier than getting beaten up in a ring doing martial arts.
You just sit still and get beat up. I mean,
yeah.
Okay. So, well,
I think there's
right
a kink
then.
Like that.
I think so too. Yeah, I need to send in a complaint to my Headspace app. I'm like, hey, right. Wait a minute. This is far too relaxing. We're doing it wrong.
Yeah, it was. I was taught under him for about a year until he returned to China. And then I was kind of looking for more meditation outlets because I had quite a strict kind of first year. And done quite a lot of deep introspection in that time. And I wanted a lot of the meditation classes were kind of, I don't want to disparage them in any way, but they weren't intense enough. So I wanted something that was more traditional and I don't know how long it was. It was probably about 7 years or so. And that I was kind of going through different meditation groups of different Buddhist traditions and that's when kind of when I got interested in the scriptures, because I wanted to. I'd been doing all this kind of meditation side of it, but I wanted to start looking at the stuff behind it. So I kind of started getting into the scriptures that way, and then the Islamic scriptures, and it was about that time when I kind of started putting together. A friend of mine had, around the same time had just converted to Islam as well. So around that time, everything kind of the earlier interest in talking to religious people, which I'd been carrying on digitally on message boards and stuff, and then the kind of the more focused side of it with the martial arts and the meditation kind of came together. And that's when I kind of started formalizing it into like any kind of serious study. It still wasn't academic at that point, but it was getting a lot more serious then.
Okay. And, you know, that's an interesting point that you bring up that we started talking about a little bit in the pre-show, too, that I'd love to hear your opinion on. And someone in the chat has kind of asked a similar question. With meditation, it seems like one of those things that some people think of it as religious or spiritual. Some people don't at all. They consider it just kind of like a mental health technique. Where do you fall on that? How do you think of meditation?
Meditation in general can be either of those things. Specifically Buddhist meditation is Buddhism, I think, is the most misunderstood religion in the West that we have. In lots of aspects, from kind of gross aspects to subtle aspects, it's very misunderstood. And it is a religion, and I come if I have any conversations about Buddhism online, it's usually about people thinking it's just a philosophy and there's no supernatural elements in it. And that's what I push back on. And I'm not saying that you're not a true Buddhist. I'm not a Buddhist. It doesn't matter to me. You can believe what you want. So I'm not saying you're not a true Buddhist if you don't believe in the supernatural elements. You could, you know, one of my very good friends, Cynthia McDonald's, practices Buddhism without any of the supernatural stuff whatsoever. That's perfectly fine. But if we're going to go back to the scriptures, if you're going to base your Buddhism on what the Buddha actually said and taught, and the reports we have that he said, then it is most definitely supernatural. It is most definitely a religious practice. And I don't think there's any way of getting around that.
Interesting. So why do you think that is, that people, especially in the West, spend so much time denying that it's religious?
I don't know. I don't think it's always denial. I think sometimes it's just ignorance of the scriptures. I think a lot of people come to kind of not just Buddhism, but all Eastern religions from the West, because they've come out of, you know, the Abrahamic faiths, and they're trying to, they still want that kind of what they consider a spiritual aspect to their lives, but they don't want all the supernatural baggage that goes with it. And there are lots of schools now, and there have been for, you know, 100 years or so, of Buddhism, that try and get rid of that kind of supernatural baggage, the more Western ones. And, you know, that's, like I said, that's absolutely fine. If that's what you want to practice and you identify as, and it works for you, that's great. Buddhist meditation is brilliant in and of itself. It's when you start looking at the deeper dimensions, that sounds like a book title. The deeper dimensions of Buddhist meditation.
It's a book idea. You heard it here first.
Yeah, it's when you start getting like more into it that the supernatural stuff has to come into play. The goal of Buddhist meditation is to stop being reborn. So if you,
yeah, if, you, yeah, if, gotta get
if
to
that's
Nirvana,
not supernatural,
man.
I don't know what is.
Yeah.
So do you think that's why there's a pushback when, especially Westerners, when, you know, they want to believe that Buddhism is a philosophy rather than a religion, because they've left like maybe more structured religion and they want a spiritual aspect. They don't want to admit that they're replacing one set of silly rules for another set of silly rules, but this set of silly rules more aligns with where they want them to go.
I don't want to say it's a one size fits all answer, because it isn't. Yeah. And there are certainly many different aspects as to why people come to it and approach it from that angle. But I think that's certainly one of, from what I've seen, one of the major contributing factors. Yeah.
You know what it's like to journey out of a once cherished belief. Maybe you were devoutly religious, escaped a cult, or perhaps you simply navigated out of some very difficult days. And now you'd like to help someone else do the same. Recovering from Religion is a wonderful support organization for people who feel confused, troubled, and alone as they come to grips with the possibility that they no longer hold a religious belief, or that they risk losing everything if they're honest with themselves and others about their journeys. These people need our help, and Recovering from Religion needs yours. RFR is seeking volunteers. Perhaps you're formerly religious, or you have a specific skill set like speaking a foreign language. Maybe you're just a good listening ear. The RFR Volunteer Training Program will help you translate those abilities into critical assistance, encouragement, and support for the men, women, and youth who contact RFR every day from all over the world. You can relate. You can understand. And you can make their journeys easier. Join the team at Recovering From Religion and remind someone else that they are not alone and someone is here to help. To find out more, click the volunteer tab at recoveringfromreligion.org.
That's interesting. And that kind of, I guess, segues very neatly into what I was going to ask next about, you know, how you got interested in this more serious academic study. But, you know, what you're sharing with us also is coming from clearly a perspective of someone who has studied what the religions are actually teaching, not just, you know, what you picked up at a yoga class or something, not that there's anything wrong with yoga. But so tell us a little bit more about that. How did this end up becoming a serious academic study of not just Buddhist philosophy, I understand, but other religions as well?
Yeah, I really started, as I said, reading the scriptures and wanting to understand more about them. And of it, I was never believing the supernatural aspects of them. So I wanted to kind of look more at the background and how they were formed and how they came together and, you know, the different... it's very difficult to say Buddhism or Christianity or Islam is a thing, because really all religions are... There are so many different aspects to them. There are Buddhisms or there are Christianities, because you don't just get, you know, if you look at a Southern Baptist, that's way, way, way different to a Mormon who is self-identifying as Christian. And so you can't, I don't think you can just put an umbrella term on things. And I started finding this out very quick. I knew this a long time ago when I was talking to religious people in my teens. But when you look at the scriptures as well and see how many ways people interpret the scriptures, that's really, there isn't a right way to, there's not a right way to interpret a scripture. But more importantly, especially for the atheist community, one of the things I come across a lot in the atheist community is atheists telling religious people that they don't know how to read their scriptures, or they're not reading the Bible right. And there are lots of ways to read it, and there are lots of ways to interpret it. If you're reading it as a believer, you're reading it completely different to somebody who's looking at the theology, and you're looking at it as something completely different to someone who's looking at it from textual criticism, and you're looking at it completely differently to somebody who's looking at it from a historical aspect. So there isn't a way to read the Bible. There are any religious scripture, there are many, many different ways. And depending on the context of your reading it and the that conversation that comes from that will depend on whether you're reading it right or not. It's not all about interpretations. There are things we can definitively say, the things we can definitively trace about, you know, the formation of scriptures, the history, historical accuracy of them. These things, there are yardsticks which we can measure them by, and that will inform a lot of whether the interpretation side of it is actually accurate or not.
My background is that I was a former Catholic, and even talking to people that are like Protestant or Southern Baptists or even Lutheran, you know, and you talk to these people and once you kind of start having those conversations about like how they see the Bible versus the way that you see it, it kind of makes you wonder if you're willing to let your mind be open to this, like, well, maybe this one way is not the only way, to be reading this, you know? And one thing like I've learned from that is, as a atheist, I don't tell a religious person that they're reading their Bible wrong, because if they're grown up Southern Baptist, that's the way they were taught to read the Bible. If, you know, if you grew up Catholic, you were taught to read the Bible that way, you know? So there is no right or wrong way to interpret something.
Yeah, there's no right or wrong way to interpret. I think it's perfect legitimate to tell, and I do this all the time on the nonprofit, so I've got to say this just to cover my own back. It's perfect legitimate to tell a religious person to actually go and read their text, because many of them don't. But that is different to the interpreter telling them they're reading it wrong. And it's that context which is important, that subtlety and difference between them not reading it at all and them not reading it in a way that you don't perceive as being right.
Spoken like a true academic. Do your homework.
Funny enough, the nonprofit show on the ACA is the only show where you actually have to do homework.
I love it. That's a great point, though, that, you know, it's you're not telling them that they're doing it wrong. You're telling them just think about it critically first and then come to a conclusion, which is presumably how I imagine you're approaching all of these texts.
Yeah, I read a lot of religious texts. I don't know if you're listening to this via audio, watching it live, but if you can see just above my head behind me, there's a series of kind of red book spines. That entire shelf is the kind of equivalent to the Buddhist Bible. That's how big it is. It's 11 times longer than the Bible. It's called the Tipitaka. That's the Pali Tipitaka. And it is absolutely huge. And on top of that, there are commentaries and things that were in a few hundred years afterwards. So that's a huge body of work in itself. And if you consider how hard it is to kind of just read the Quran or the Bible and get a reasonable kind of academic understanding, that you can imagine how much more it is for that. And I just have my head stuck in books all day, as well as having a young family and working full time, because I'm just a glutton for punishment.
Yeah, it would seem so. My goodness. Well, yeah, I'm impressed with that number of volumes. I'd be impressed if anybody had made it through that, which certainly people have. But I'm curious to know, in your journey, as you've been studying all of these texts and everything, it sounds like you started out with an interest out of a, I don't want to say utilitarian place, but you were practicing martial arts and then came upon this as a part of that practice. It sounded like you were practicing to some extent. And at some point you kind of made a shift to studying the texts as documents, as, you know, more of an academic pursuit. How did that shift your perspective and what led to that shift?
I think from practicing reading them and practicing, it was a case of trying to get the background knowledge of, to get a deeper dimension of the kind of martial arts and meditation practice. Then the shift came when I just wanted to learn more about them. It was as simple as that, because I didn't believe any of the supernatural stuff in them, even when I was reading them from a practical point of view. And I think knowing that there was supernatural stuff in there, but there was also some practical stuff in there for what I was doing. What I wanted to know, kind of sort through the wheat and the chaff and get the good stuff and find out why it was good, rather than, as I said, I've always been interested in why people believe what they believe. And I think I wanted to get through that and kind of get to the why is this useful. Why is this the way this is? Why is it written in a certain way? When was it written? And all those questions were coming up. And, you know, so really the only way to answer those is to go to the academic sources. Because if I could have gone to a Tibetan Buddhist group and got one answer. I could have gone to a Theravadan Buddhist group and got another answer, a Zen group and got a different answer. So really I had to cut all those perspectives out. and go to the kind of the academic sources to get that. Unfortunately, in Buddhism, probably more even so than Christianity, a lot of the academic sources come from the practitioners themselves. So you've still got an element of that kind of bias coming in there. But, you know, as with any academic work, you've got to try and put your yardstick hat on and sort through opinion, which, you know, all or even the academic works, sorry to tell you, really just people who think that skeptics and atheists are perfect. Even, you know, academic work is biased to some extent. So you've got to kind of try and push through that a little bit. And the way to do that in academia is just to, you know, look at as many sources as possible. So that's something I found in the atheist communities. I talk about this a lot. So if you've heard me speak before, I apologize for repeating myself. But I think a lot of people will pull the opinions of people like Bart Ehrman or Joshua Bowen, who are very, 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 very good academics, and kind of say, this is the academic opinion. But do not discount believing academics. There are some very good Christian believing academics out there who write very, very good scholarship. Don't discount them just because they are Christian practicing and you are not, and you're an atheist. That is a really big mistake, because some of them are really, really good. And the kind of, you've got to remember that academics aren't apologists. And while they will have their bias, they will, generally speaking, not in every case, but generally speaking, try and separate their bias from their academic work. And, you know, to the point where they will outright say, and I've heard Christian academics say this before, this is the consensus agreement. It is not one I share. And that's fair enough. That's separating your bias from your academic work. Whereas when you move into apologist territory, and a lot of apologists have done a lot of academic work, but their focus is, my belief is right because, and they're not so, but they know the academia, but they're not so bothered about employing the academia to inform themselves. They're more bothered about using it as a weapon. So a genuine academic is, you know, listen to them. Even if you don't agree with them, because that's going to inform a wider picture. If you live in an echo chamber, you're not going to learn anything, ever.
You know, that is such a good point. I'm really glad you brought that up, because I do, you know, get frustrated with the apologists all the time, because basically what you said, you know, sometimes I feel like there may be a bit of intellectual dishonesty happening in an effort to convince people or make a particular point, but it's not fair then to assume that all religious academics are operating in that same way. I mean, it's basically accusing them of being, you know, academically or intellectually dishonest, which it would not be fair to paint everyone with that brush any more than to say that, you know, all atheist academics are always right all the time and good intentioned and have no bias. I mean, and that's, of course, you know, silly. Like you said, we all have a bias. So that's a really good point. Can you think off the top of your head of any, I'm a super big book nerd, in case no one's noticed, what are some academic books that you found particularly compelling that might be presenting a religious perspective?
Oh, there's a book called Introduction to the New Testament by John Drane. Is a Christian, is a very hardcore Christian. But if you get that book and you get a book, I think it's got a very similar title, by Dr. Bart Ehrman, and you read them side to side, you will find that 90% of the things agree with each other. And that's a mark of good, you know, academia, that they will agree on the points of, you know, the consistent points, the points where we've got evidence for, you know, where the both of those guys look at the formations of the scriptures, where they came from, the source texts, And if you read those two books side by side, you get a very, very similar, consistent message. And that's a good sign of a good academic, when you get two people of such contrasting views and they do have that agreement. They don't agree perfectly, of course, but you know, as I don't think you'd ever get any two academics that agree perfectly, but no. it's a very good kind of that's a test I'd use. That there are lots of good religious academic books written by religious believers. I mean, putting me on the spot, asking me to to pick
hey,
them
that's,
out.
I can't name
them off the top of my head. Yeah, that John Drane Introduction to Christianity is the New Testament is a good one. He's also written an introduction to the Old Testament. I don't want to kind of big one person up too much, but they are really, really good books.
Yeah. Well, so, Helen, I like that. Oh, sorry. Go ahead, Helen. Yeah.
So kind of, you know, bouncing off of that kind of idea, so as an academic and a non-believer, have you had discussions with believers in an academic setting? And what kind of like conversations have you had, and the different perspective that they're taking away from, you know, an academic text that you're learning in class, and how those discussions go when they're a believer and you're not? Like, have you had any really interesting conversations and get kind of into their brain on what they're thinking about as they're learning more of the rigorous study of religion rather than just reading the Bible on Sunday at church?
Not particularly from the perspective of being at university and learning this stuff, because I started distance learning because the pandemic had hit. So I've not actually been in the same room as any of my fellow students. I'm entering my third year of my course now. So, and I've not met physically any of my fellow students yet. So that's been something that I've not had the opportunity to do. And when I've interacted with them online, it's been very cordial. And we've talked more about the kind of practical aspects of what we're learning, rather than any disagreements we might have. We're aware we have disagreements, but we approach them very respectfully. From the perspective of, in general, online interactions, I don't think I've had much interaction with actual academic believing Christians who aren't apologists. And I've had lots of interactions with apologists, and they go a completely different route, because, as I say, they kind of weaponize academia and use it to defend the position and kind of discard that stuff which doesn't defend the position. I had a conversation about a year ago, I think, with a Muslim guy, and we were talking about a particular book. I can't remember the name of it. It was something to do with textual criticism of the Quran. And it's a really good book. And he pointed me to this academic paper that had been written kind of responding to it from the Islamic perspective. And the first thing it said in this academic paper was that you can't properly understand the Quran unless you're a believer, so any criticism of it that doesn't come from that perspective can be discounted. And that's the kind of stuff that you come across quite a lot when you start talking to apologists. It's very difficult to kind of get round that barrier.
It's kind of almost one of those things. I think there was a conversation going on in the chat a minute ago about, well, we know it's true because the text says that it's true. Well, if I don't believe that premise, we've gone nowhere with that argument.
Yeah, we can all come from that angle, you know. I can say that the flying teapot is true because I believe it is true. You know, that's easy to do. Anybody can do that. It's useless. It's useless philosophically. It's very often employed in philosophy, but it's absolutely useless just doing that. You know, I'm right because I'm right is fair enough. You can make a legitimate philosophical claim that you can say that, but it's absolutely useless if you want a conversation with someone.
Right. This is the way that you make your children believe something, but as soon as they're able to think about it themselves, they may not be forced to accept that premise any longer. It reminds me a little bit of what you were saying earlier. I know when you say that people might weaponize academic work in order to use it for apologism. I know my I have a family member who's always, you know, trying to convince me with new arguments from, well, they're not new, it's the same arguments from the apologists, but she got one time where it was someone citing an anthropological source about, you know, mitochondrial Eve, and see, the scientists have discovered that there really was an Adam and Eve, and cite an academic article using that term. And of course, that is not at all what that is referring to. But it's almost like a way of trying to, you know, hang your argument on, oh, see, this is academic. But if anyone were to go and actually read the source, like you mentioned earlier, they would realize that the academic source does not likely arrive at the conclusion that the apologist is pointing us towards. So I'm wondering, having, you know, studied religion, you know, more intensely now, do you have any like pet peeve arguments that people will use, or claims that they will make that are not in fact academically based?
I think my pet peeves are, I don't think they've changed, to be honest with you, over the years. My pet peeves, they've just become more intense as I hear people use them more. It's very hard when you've been doing this as long as I've been doing this to kind of, I try and take conversations on an individual basis, and I try and, it doesn't always work. I sometimes lose my temper. I'm not going to lie and pretend I'm perfect. But I'd try and come at every conversation with every new religious person I talk to from the perspective of, you know, I want to have a conversation. I don't want to kind of tell you what I think. I don't want you to tell me what you to think. I want us to share information. And, you know, my focus is not necessarily telling people what they believe is wrong. My focus is kind of getting people to understand that you shouldn't believe something until you've got a good reason to believe it. And that's always my focus. That's always what I come back onto. But I think it's very, very difficult when you've been having these conversations, when somebody tells you that the evidence for God existing is just look around you and look at the world around you for the 150 millionth time. And they think it's a unique argument that they've just come up with, and they're sharing this information with you. It's very, very difficult not to get, you know, high rate and frustrated over that to at the beginning of the conversation. It takes a lot of my effort goes into not losing my temper with some, because a lot of people, these people legitimately believe this is the case, and they're coming in and they've not talked to people before, and they've not had these conversations before, and you don't want to put them off by just shouting, you know, you are wrong at them. You know, and it's very difficult not to do that, like I said, when you've been doing this thing for stuff for 30 years and you've had this argument thrown at you for 30 years and somebody comes along and they think they're the originator of the argument and they've got a gotcha. And it's frustrating. Lots of arguments like that frustrate me. The kind of standard kind of apologetics arguments really frustrate me. I like the more subtle things. I like the things about you know, when people say that the resurrection is proof of Christianity and it proves supernatural claims, I like stuff like that, which are a little bit more subtle. You can go into them in a lot more subtle ways. And, you know, they're my favorite conversations to have, but they're not ones I have very often, because you usually, as I say, each new person thinks that this age-old argument they've got, the Kalam cosmological argument, is one that really winds me up. Like really, really gets under my skin.
I hate that argument.
Because it's so blatantly easy to refute at every stage. And people think that they've really, really got a new angle on it every time they bring it up.
That one gets me too. It's not new. It's not new. We've heard that before, and it's
a thousand years old.
This was
in its modern form.
Yes. Yes. It's been refuted thoroughly centuries ago.
I can definitely understand that frustration though, because I don't like to debate people because I just get frustrated. And like, I'm not well versed in a lot of these arguments, you know? So I'm just going to get frustrated and start skipping over my words. And then I'm going to get mad and yell at them. And then the theist will be like, I won. So, you know, like, I don't want to get into those conversations, but I can understand, like, if you've been having it's, and it's always the same arguments, there's nothing new under the sun. It's just the same stuff that always comes back, that after a while I would just be like, all right, fine, yes, okay, there's trees, yes, God exists, good for it, great. You know, like, yeah, well, that, I can't the trees
look
exist,
at the trees,
so
you just feel
God.
Like saying, okay, I'll let you have that, because I just can't be bothered to argue against it,
right?
I think the only time I really lost my rag from beginning a conversation with someone, I'm not going to name the person who called in, but I was hosting Ethan Michael's Perspective Show once, and someone who kind of does the rounds on the call shows, or did do the rounds on the call shows, called in.
I already have like three or four names right in my head right and, now.
It was the first time I'd ever talked to him. And I just, before we even began, I just said, look, we're not going to work from your script. I'm not doing it. I'm not interested in doing it. If you want a conversation, we'll have it. But if you're not interested in a conversation, just sling your rook somewhere, because I'm not interested. And that was, I think that was the only time, especially on a call-in show, where I've really just kind of lost my temper, because I knew the reputation of the guy. I'd heard him so many times before I even spoke to him. But I'm not like that, really. Just people come and talk to me, because I do like genuine, nice conversations. If you're coming at it from, if it's blatantly obvious that you genuinely want this conversation and you're trying to understand and you're trying to learn if you just come out and you want to know what atheists believe because you've not really had a chance to speak to any, you know, I'm more than happy to have a sit down conversation and talk to you. That's what I want to do.
Well, and okay, I want to get your perspective on this. I always kind of wonder about this. I know with the call-in shows, like they have on the ACA and the other ones that you've been on, you know, sometimes it's people calling in who are, you know, practicing their apologetics or something like that. But generally speaking, do you get the sense that, you know, if someone is listening to an atheist call-in show and going to the effort to call in sometimes repeatedly, it seems to me, but I want to know what you think, that person may actually be questioning and wondering if they have the right answer or if there's more to it or not. What's your sense of that? Even the ones that are a bit more combative.
Yeah, I would always try, and unless it's a known kind of troll or a known apologist, I would always approach every call like the genuinely wanting to, and whether it's calling show or in person or on the internet, anybody who's talking to you, as though they're genuinely wanting to learn your position.
Yeah.
And I want to stress here that I'm not saying learn because I'm right and they know they're wrong. I mean, just to genuinely learn the other person's position and learn a little bit more about it, because that's what we all do. That's what I do every day when I read a religious text. I'm learning the position of those people who wrote that text, and I think that's very important to do that. And I think most people who I talk to, at least, do have at least a hint of that genuineness about them, and it's great. There's, you know, I'm in the very lucky position where I've had people turn around to me and, you know, and write to me and say, you know what, you've really helped me see a different perspective. And that is the best feeling in the world. When you get an email like that, or if somebody tells you that, that is the best feeling in the world, because you might not, you know, I don't go out to deconvert people. I don't care if you want to carry on being religious. What I want to do is instill better thinking in you. And if I've done that in even a minor way, which leads you down the road, you know, I don't want to deconvert you. What I want you to do is get you thinking about things yourself, so that you believe things for good reasons. And then you do the work and you put the effort in, and whatever conclusion you come to from that is, you know, good on you, as long as you've done it honestly and put the work in.
Yeah. Well, and that that benefits everyone then, when, you know, people are out thinking about other perspectives in a clear-headed kind of way, that maybe they will come up with a new version of the Kalam argument that works better. I mean, who knows? Maybe not that in particular, but something else.
Was there ever a conversation that you particularly had with, like, when someone called in that made you want to learn, go to like a text or something that you had and like learn more, like heard something you hadn't heard before that you wanted more knowledge on?
I think the only call I can, and I don't think I actually, I didn't take the call. It wasn't a show I was on and speaking to the person, but I heard him on a person, and then I spoke to him afterwards on social media after he'd called in. And I think he's called into a couple of different shows. Was a Raelian guy who believes in the Raelian movement. And I knew nothing about it until this guy called in. So I really wanted to have a look into that.
And, yeah, and what and, is that?
Yeah, Carter are the same day. I was like, what?
Yeah, it's kind of, I'm not sure of the exact details, so I'm not going to give specific details because I will get them wrong. It was a French guy who, I think it was in the 60s or the 70s, claimed he'd been abducted by aliens who'd given him all this knowledge, and he connected to them via meditation, and he was the reincarnation of Buddha, and he had all these unique insights into all the other religions because these aliens had told him that was the case. And I knew nothing about that. It was until I'd heard this call. And I ended up having kind of months of discourse with this Raelian guy, both publicly on forums and kind of via private messages. And I found it fascinating.
Wow. Okay. Well,
now I'm curious. I'm going to be doing a wiki and probably fall down a rabbit hole later.
Oh. It's not a fun rabbit hole to fall down.
Oh, it's not. Oh, damn. I like fun rabbit holes.
Too late. You know we're both going to Google that later.
We are. Yeah. We're going to look at your happen.
Yeah, we're going to do an episode.
Yeah, I did a little bit of a deep dive into it because I did an episode on cults. And so I'd kind of heard this guy talk, and I did a little bit more digging about them for that episode. And, you know, his ex-wife, I found a newspaper article where his ex-wife was talking about the abuse she'd suffered through him and things, and lots of sad, you know, sad stories like that. And it really just kind of, it frustrated me that, the followers of this movement kind of knew about that and still wanted to practice it and still thought it was okay to practice following someone like that. That's the sad side of, as you guys know more than anybody, the sad side of religion is the harm it causes.
Right. Yeah. And the continuation of that harm because of a lack of willingness or ability or incentive to look more closely and see or to question. Yeah, that's so dangerous. And that's what I love about, you know, what you came to talk about, you know, thinking skeptically or academically about religious beliefs. You know, it's okay to study and think critically at the same time. And I love that you came by that, I would say, honestly. It sounds like from your story, you know, sometimes people will, you know, go get a degree in something in order to refute it or argue it or something like that. And that doesn't strike me as you.
Let me be clear as to why I set out doing my degree. My wife has got lots of degrees. She's very clever. She's got degrees in politics and economics and master's degrees in educational psychology and all sorts of wonderful things that I don't understand. And she for years, for and at least 10 years, at least 10 years has been saying to me, go, you're really interested in this stuff, go and do a degree in it, you know, formalize your interest, get something on paper, maybe down the line you'll be able to work in the area that you love. And, you know, and I was just like, no, I'm not a degree kind of person. No, I don't want to go as far as to say I grew up on the streets, as that's not true, but I've certainly been in more than my fair share of barroom brawls. Let's put it that way. So I never considered myself kind of, you know, an academic person. Even when I was doing stuff academically, I never considered myself an academic. I still don't. I still kind of look at myself. I've got a bit of imposter syndrome, I think, when I talk about this stuff. So why am I talking about academic stuff? Because I'm not really an academic, you know.
I think that's a sign that you might have become an expert in your field. As soon as you realize that you don't know anything about it, it's a clue.
I'm certainly not an expert in my field. But no, it was my wife who pushed me to kind of do this formally and get the degree. And I started it, like I say, I'm entering my third year now. So it was about 2 years ago. All this started, the kind of intense online and the kind of formalizing and talking to people all started about 2 years ago. Because before that, like I said, it had just been done in the street and via message boards and on social media and things. So the pandemic was great for me. From that perspective, it was bad for me because I actually got COVID before there was any vaccinations, and I'm still having tests because it really badly affected me. But from the other side of things, it was really good for me. You know, I've made a lot of new friends and got involved in all these different communities because I started spending a lot more time online.
Yeah, you know, I wanted to ask you about that too. If you felt like, you know, after COVID, that there's been kind of a change in the way that you're able to communicate with people about these kind of questions, do you feel like that opened up more opportunities for these conversations?
For me personally, yes. I can't speak for everybody. I was having these conversations, like I said, in the old days on the message boards when I started using the internet, and then I kind of got married, and honestly,
you kind of got married.
I kind of got married. I kind of had kids.
I got frustrated because, not because of the marriage or the children, but I got frustrated because in Britain at the time when I was having these conversations, I saw, in the atheist communities, I saw a lot of copycat arguments. It was, you know, everybody at the time was just getting into kind of, you know, the God delusion was a big thing. It had come out a couple of years before. And I just saw a lot of parroted arguments. And it was really, really frustrating me. So I kind of left the online talking, still did it in the street when I saw people. But I left the online talking for about 5 or 6 years until I kind of started listening to, I came across The Atheist Experience on YouTube, and Matt Dillahunty was saying something to someone, and I thought, I say that stuff, and none of the atheists I've been talking to before say that stuff. So it really piqued my interest that I was kind of hearing someone who was on a similar wavelength to what I was on, and that's what kind of got me looking more at the ACA kind of stuff. But yeah, I left the online community for about, I don't know how long it was, somewhere between about 5 and 8 years. Because I didn't want those conversations with people on the atheist side who were in an echo chamber. I don't like echo chambers. I don't care what side of the argument you're on. I don't want to listen to someone who's in an echo chamber. I want someone who genuinely wants a conversation.
You know, that is a question that we have gotten from people a few different times before here. And I wonder if you could speak a little more on that. What kinds of things do you do to try and make sure that you're not in an echo chamber? And how do you know if you're in an echo chamber?
It's very difficult to know if you're in an echo chamber. I think, as I said from the beginning of the show, when I first started talking to religious people, I went away and thought about things. And then, you know, the meditation obviously helped focus that. Not obviously, because if you don't know anything about meditation, you might not know that. But it helped me focus, I think is a best way to put it. And just kind of deepen that introspection. And, you know, I've no interest in me being right. I want to know as many true things as I can know. And that's what motivates me not to be in an echo chamber. Just to kind of look outside of my own opinion and look at other people's opinions and, you know, try and assess that as best I can. It's always going to be bias present. You can't get away from it with the best will in the world. But to try and put that bias aside as much as possible is I think, how I try and do it personally. And if I catch myself, sometimes you miss it completely. I'm sure there are many, many biases I have I'm not aware of. But when you catch that bias, then do something about it. Rather than just being aware of it and saying, well, let's just shove that aside. We don't need to know about that.
Well, and I think so too, like for those of us who have left religion, because your religions are very biased, and you think that once you leave religion, you let go of all the bullshit, you're suddenly not biased. Like, I have an open mind and nothing, you know, I will never be biased again. And then lo and behold, you found out that, oh, wait, yeah, I am, you know.
I will shout from the rooftop that atheists are not skeptics. I can argue all day long with atheists just as I can with religious people about skepticism.
Yeah. And I think, you know, thinking, like you said, Helen, you know, thinking that you don't have a bias is the quickest way to start deluding yourself into believing your own BS. Yeah, absolutely.
Because I've seen it in the atheist community, as Richard said, you know, people that think that, you know, their shit don't stink. And like, I have all the answers. And then, but I'm like, but are you growing? Are you changing your perspective? Are you learning? You know, just, you know, and I think that, you know, that's a good lesson for all of us, just as going forward, that it's okay to be wrong, and it's okay to change your perspective and to let go of some of your biases. It's okay. Like, you know, that's, you know, evolve, people, evolve.
Straw manning religious people is just as bad as religious people straw manning atheists.
Right.
It doesn't become right just because you're an atheist. You know, if you want to create an argument for a religious person and knock that argument down and feel superior. And, you know, I see this constantly, almost daily, I'm one of the admins for the ACA's many, many message boards, fan run message boards. And, you know, the amount of people who come on saying, listen to my argument, isn't it fantastic? And you just kind of think, nobody has that opinion. You're just arguing against something that doesn't exist. And it happens all the time.
It does. And, you know, I think that I've been thinking about that a lot myself, too. And I think it does have to do with when we bring in our own bias into things. Like, I grew up personally in a very extremist version of Christianity. And so there are sometimes when I can think about, you know, some of those really silly beliefs and ideas and point out, you know, how absurd that is. And of course, that is, you know, demonstrably false. But sometimes I can even catch myself forgetting that, you know, that's not the position of all Christians. That's not what even most or many religious people think. It's not, it would not be fair of me to think I've now, you know, taken down this belief system by, you know, refuting, you know, that, you know, the sun does not revolve around the earth. You know, it's not a serious argument.
Flat, Kara.
Right. I mean, my mistake. But, you know, and I think we, you know, we're susceptible to that sometimes when we come out of a belief system that was harmful or that pushed certain really offensive and obviously either incorrect or immoral or unethical beliefs onto us. It's easy for us to seize on that and go, look, see how ridiculous these belief systems are. But, you know, that may not really be a genuine reflection of what a great many people who adhere to those religions really think. So
I caught myself doing it today. I was talking to a Hindu on one of the social media platforms, and I had to delete my message because as I read it back before I posted it, I realized that what I was saying is, you believe this. And I thought, why am I making that assessment? Because I don't actually know what that person believes. And so, like I say, I do this stuff all the time, and I'm prone to it as much as anybody. So, you know, it happens to all of us. As good as we think we are.
Richard, I'm very proud that you read your text before sending it. like, more people need to do that, me included.
Like, well, I have no choice.
I'm going to give you a gold star for that.
If I want to look academic, I've got to do that because my spelling is atrocious.
That is so true. Okay, so this is really fascinating, and we have to shortly start moving towards the Q&A session, but before we hear some more of your final thoughts, I have a very unserious, non-academic question that I have been dying to ask you for the last hour, and I'm going to ask you now. Are you ready? Okay, my question is, which Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtle are you, Richard? Do you have a favorite?
I'm going to say Leonardo because honestly, it's the only one I can remember.
Okay, well, that's a fair answer. Okay, I'll accept that. Helen, do you want to weigh in on this?
I didn't watch Ninja Turtles, so I don't. But I, what is your favorite Monty Python sketch? And you're a Brit. So if you don't have one, I'm going to be so disappointed.
that is a good question. I think I don't even know which one it's called. There's a role reversal one where Graham Chapman plays a playwright who's dressed as a miner with a Yorkshire accent. And I don't remember who the other guy in the sketch is, but he plays a miner with a southern accent who's got a suit on. And it's kind of a class role reversal thing where the kind of guy with the Yorkshire accent who's dressed like a miner is talking about having writer's cramp because he's been at so many playwriting sessions. And the guy in the suit with the kind of posh accent is talking about working down the pit all the day. And that's a great sketch. I don't remember the name of it, but check it out if you can. It's fantastic.
Okay. Outstanding. All right. Sorry for that brief distraction from our serious conversation, but we had inquiring minds needed to know the answer.
This is the deep stuff.
Right. This is perhaps a deepity.
I mentioned earlier that me and Helen are friends, and this is kind of the level that our friendship is on.
Yeah, that's pretty much it.
Yeah,
we both hated the new Thor movie, so.
Ooh, and we need to talk more about that in the hangout as
You're
well.
Right, exactly.
I have questions, and we need to ask you about movies too. I promised we were going to ask you about movies, and we haven't gotten to that yet, but we're going to. Everyone, stand by for that. But okay, before we just devolve into complete and utter nonsense, which hey, maybe that's what we're here for. Richard, thank you for your comments this evening. Before we go to Q&A, is there anything else that you want to cover that we haven't talked about yet, or any other comments that you want to leave us with?
The only thing I would say, Nate, this is my thing. I'm a one-trick pony. It's really, if you want to talk to me, it's really, really simple. If you want to believe something, make sure that you have good evidence that it's true. Something being true in reality can be demonstrated. And if it can't be demonstrated or you don't have good reasons for believing it, then inquire into yourself as to why you believe that to begin with. And kind of, you have to do the work. I don't want to sound like a flat earther saying you've got to go and do the research. But put the work in and ask yourself, why do I believe this? Because I don't have any good reason to believe it. So why is it that I do believe it? And start that journey.
Excellent advice. I appreciate that very much. And we're applying that to ourselves as well as other people. Yeah. So, okay. Before we go to Q&A, and we do have quite a few questions for you that I'm excited about. Where can people find you if they want to hear more about you and more from you? And I have to say, there are some other people in the chat who are inquiring if you give voice lessons because they want to sound more like you as well.
I have no idea why anyone would want to sound like me. I've got my own YouTube channel called Skeptic Takeout. Honestly, there's not been that much on it in the past year because the episodes take me that long to write. It could take me 2 months to write an episode. So, and I've been really, really busy over the last year. So there's very few things on there recently. It is still active. There will be stuff going up, but there's old content on there you can have a look at. Skeptic Hangout is a weekly podcast that I started and host with three very good friends of mine who are all... I met all through kind of doing this kind of work, and I love that because it's entirely unscripted. We pick a topic, sometimes 2 minutes before we go out, we record it, and we'll pick a topic and we will talk about it regardless of whether we have knowledge about it or not. We just try and apply skepticism to it. And that's everything from we've talked about America, we've talked about the monarchy, we've talked about God, aliens, ghosts, the Dead Sea Scrolls, everything in between. We just pick a subject and we go with it. And we've had some great guests on there. We've had a friend of mine, Dr. Richard Firth, God be here, who wrote A Human History of Emotion. That's a really, really good book. He's been on there a couple of times. We have Kenneth Leonard, who does stuff for the ACA. We've had Jenna Belk on there. I think she was one of our first guests. So we have occasional guests on there, but usually it's one of the combination of the four of us and just ad-libbing. The Nonprofits is another place you can find me, which is, as Helen knows, is not quite so freeform, and you have to do your own work and read the news articles and write notes. That's another great platform. The ACA stuff, I'm heavily involved with the ACA, so go and look at the Nonprofits. You'll be able to catch me doing the occasional Talk Heathen or the occasional Truth Wanted. I've been on both those shows twice, I think. So just around. The Bloody Good Film Podcast, I'm on all of the month of September talking wrestling movies, because one thing we didn't get into is that I am actually an ex-wrestler.
How did we not get into that?
We invited you, Richard. They invited me on for Wrestle Monthia on the Bloody Good Film Podcast, where we're talking about wrestling movies for the whole month. So go and check that out as well.
Also, watch his review of the God's Not Dead movies.
That is the first place that I saw you, actually, or heard you, was the reviews of those movies. Yes. I enjoyed that greatly, because those movies irritate me to no end.
Yeah, the plan is to do the whole series of them.
I'm here for it. I am here for that. I mean, it's like torture going through them, you know, one by one, but you can't look away. It's like watching a train wreck. So
it is. They're a challenge, but feel like when you get through one, like you like got a notch in your belt, like you climbed like Mount Everest. It's like, okay, yes. Like, yay, you did the thing.
Yes, it's an achievement. Okay, well, I guess we should move into the Q&A now, and I think that there will be more questions about this in the Q&A, but okay, let's see here. What do we have? We have a number of questions for you. Are you ready to answer some questions, Richard?
Yeah, throw them at me, see what we've got.
Yeah, you can decline. It's okay. I'm not sure that's ever happened on here, if someone's just said, no, I'm not answering that.
I don't think it's ever happened.
I don't think that's ever happened.
As long as we've been doing this.
Yeah. No pressure. No. Okay, so I think these will be good. So someone was wondering, going back to the meditation topic from the beginning, what is the difference between secular meditation as opposed to religious meditation? And is there a health benefit? Are there risks involved? Thoughts?
Oh, that's a very good question. It's also a very hard one to answer in a couple of minutes. There doesn't have to be a difference from the methodical side of it. Essentially, meditation is breathing in and breathing out and being aware of your breath. You don't need any religious aspect to it whatsoever. If you're doing it as part of the Buddhist system, then there are lots of different aspects which are affected by the kind of religious aspects of it that you take into account, and certain states of consciousness that you're told you can achieve, and things like that. So if you're aiming for them, there are certain practices to do to try and get there. So it is affected by it. Health benefits, yeah. It can make you calmer, make you more grounded, settled. It's very, very good. It can really help you kind of settle down. One thing I've not done any academic research on this, so I don't know what the academic thing is. From the Buddhist perspective, people who have who may be prone to kind of mania and things like that, or different mental health conditions, it is said not to, that they shouldn't do it, because to kind of get the full religious benefit out of it, you're supposed to be able to be in a place where you're grounded to begin with. It's not just a case that you can, this is scripturally, this is not me talking, I'm just talking from the scriptural perspective. You're not supposed to just walk into it and start doing it without some kind of grounding to begin with. But I don't, there've been lots of studies on it, and some of them are a bit dubious. I'd say it's more beneficial to do it than not do it. I'm not a medical person, so I don't want to go into, I don't want to give medical advice, but I certainly think in general, it'd be more beneficial to have 5 or 10 minutes meditation a day than not to do any. It'll ground you and calm you down and kind of all that good stuff. It has done for me. So that's, without giving medical advice, that's my experience of it. So I assume other people, because I'm not in any way unique as a human being, will have the same experience.
Fair enough. Disclaimer, we do not give medical advice on this channel. All comments are people's own opinions. Do your research. Do your homework, not do your research.
Do your own research. Just watch YouTube research. Videos. No. That's all the research.
It's no, not what that. We are advocating. Don't do that. Oh, good times. All right. Helen, would you like to give us another question?
Yes, I would. So by studying so-called holy writings free from any preconceived biases, did that help you apply your critical thinking skills?
Yeah, I think it did. I think because there's some stuff in there which is obviously bullshit, and I think we're, if you're not indoctrinated into that system where you're taught that that's true, I think you can, that stands out a mile off, and it certainly helps. And you know, you pick new ones. When I first started reading the Bible, and it was, you know, things didn't make sense. The Garden of Eden story didn't make sense. The serpent didn't lie. God may have lied. It certainly insinuated that he lied, even though it doesn't say it outright. And that was just the complete opposite of what was kind of taught it as Christians, to talk to people as Christians who I'd talked to, who said the serpent's a devil and he lied to Adam and Eve. No, he didn't. And I didn't have that bias to kind of come into that. And I read that, and I read it kind of at first without any kind of knowledge of the how the text was formulated, or who was writing it, or possibly writing it or anything. I was just reading it as a text, and a lot of stuff was standing out that I'd heard Christians say, no, that's just wrong. Why do you believe that? You know, that God's forgetful, he puts the rainbow in the sky after the flood because he is forgetful. It's a ribbon round the finger. It's a piece of string round the finger to remind him not to do it again. God is forgetful, so how can he have all knowledge? And just stuff like that just stands out when you're not coming from that indoctrination point of view. Just obvious, easy, obvious stuff stands out that everybody should know, and people don't because they're so deeply indoctrinated.
That always
the rainbow there because he's secretly gay. That's the real reason. Spoiler, guys.
I mean, I'm pretty sure God is non-binary. I remember very clearly hearing that God does not have a gender. I'm just throwing that out.
I know
there.
He's queer. I'm pretty sure. Yeah. They're queer. They are queer.
That's what I learned in religious private school. So I'm just saying. I'm not saying, but I'm just saying.
Saying. If you follow the evidence, yeah. Evidence, and I use that loosely.
Yes.
Sorry, this is the type of tangents we go on. Yeah. I apologize.
It happens. We get on tangents. When Helen and I get together, it's
tangents.
It's all over. It's tangents on tangents. Okay, but we did have a related follow-up question to that one, which I will now ask, because this is a serious program. So, in your opinion, what effect does this kind of unbiased, or, you know, as unbiased as possible, academic education of religion have on people's beliefs?
On religious people's beliefs.
I guess the question is getting at, is there a difference if you study the religious texts from an academic perspective rather than from a spiritual one, or from like learning from your minister?
Yeah, definitely. I think it's, you know, we touched upon this a little bit earlier on, that there are different ways to read and understand the Bible. And the more of those ways you learn, the more informed you're going to be, and that's going to give you a completely different perspective than what you're taught from the pulpit. A lot of ministers, I've spoken to ministers of non-denominational sects, I don't know if that's a word, schools of Christianity, where they don't seem to have any knowledge of the academic background. It depends which you know, I got given a Church of England vicar, is a friend of mine, and she gave me a really good book called An Introduction to Christian Theology, which is given to kind of vicars when they're learning, you know, the first going in. It's part of the kind of literature they're given to help them along, and that's a really, really good book. And so I think that's by Alistair McGrath, and that's a Christian book, obviously written by a Christian believer, given to people who want to become vicars. So it's obviously all religious orientated, but it gives them a different perspective, and that's good that they're going into that and ministry and the learning the actual, some of the academic stuff behind it, rather than just as some non-denominational preachers do, just kind of using the Bible to inform them. And so, yeah, it's if you are a religious person, reading more of the academic stuff is going to inform you and give you a different opinion. It may not change your beliefs. In a lot of cases, it does. A lot of cases, people become atheist because they start reading the academic literature and it doesn't make sense to them. But I suppose that's depends on the individual and what kind of background they've come from and what school of religion, where they're based, you know, how much they're indoctrinated, all that stuff applies to that. It's never a one-size-fits-all answer in these things.
Yeah, of course. That makes sense. Yeah. All right. Do we have another question, Helen?
We do. So most faiths believe you cannot study the test on your own, but need a teacher from within the faith. What are your thoughts on that?
I think from a religious perspective, that is pretty much a universal teaching. I don't know of any faith off the top of my head that doesn't say that you need a teacher within. Most of them also say that you, to a lesser or greater extent, depending on which particular school of that faith you're part of, will say that you're not to associate with people from outside of the faith to a greater or lesser extent, whether that's getting knowledge to them, or some of them will say don't associate with people at all who are from outside of your faith. You know, you shouldn't form friendships with people who aren't Christian or Buddhist or Muslim or whatever. I think universally they will all say you should listen to the teachers and other members of the faith to inform you.
And do you agree?
Well, no, I don't agree. I think it's part of an indoctrination process that, you know, you should only listen to your teacher. You know, that there's only one answer as to why that is. And that's because mm-hmm. they don't want you getting information from elsewhere. They want mm-hmm. you to think that they are right.
Yeah. Yeah. That is a major red flag to me as well. When someone says, oh, you can't possibly understand this on your own. Okay. Yeah. Okay. Now I'm suspicious. Yeah. My ears are perked up. Okay. So we've got another question here. Wondering, have the recent years of tension and stress on the world scene in general affected the types of conversations that you've had with religious people? And do you feel that people are doubling down more nowadays on their beliefs and opinions?
That's hard to answer. I'm not quite sure. I think I'd like to say yes, but I think that's just because of the number of conversations that I have but if I'm honest and I think back even to when I first started having conversations, you know, if I take, for example, talking to a Muslim in the streets of Sheffield when I was 14 years old who had a stall there, those conversations haven't changed much over the years. As you know, I said earlier on in the show that, you know, you can have the same arguments over and over again for the millionth time. It's a hard, I have more frequent conversations now, so I get more different perspectives. And so, I think overall, they're probably they're using the same arguments, they're using the same conversations.
That's interesting.
Do you think it's like because, you know, there's so much pushback against, you know, there's a lot more people, especially protesting, and they're voicing more, especially those not even like atheists, just people that don't want religion being a part of like any sort of governmental structure. You know, and I think, do you think that like religious people are just feeling much more threatened now, and that's why there's so much pushback against that right now?
I don't know. Maybe. I mean, I'm in the UK, so it's a different situation. I've no idea what's happening in America. It's crazy how you can even have the consideration from any perspective whatsoever that creationism is equally as valid as evolution to be taught in schools, and it get to any stage where it's considered that that can happen is just beyond me. I don't understand America.
Welcome to the club.
We live here. We don't understand.
We don't get it. No explanation. Okay.
Kind of answered this question, which was about, you know, religious people being kind of stuck in an echo chamber. So I'm going to kind of modify this question because we kind of already answered it. What advice would you give a skeptic to not get stuck in an echo chamber?
Just check yourself. I can only answer for me personally. I become aware of when I'm being biased, and I become aware of when I may be using a bad argument or parroting somebody else. And you've got two choices when you become aware of that. You can either continue doing it and ignore it, in which case you're stuck in an echo chamber, or you can modify yourself and look at yourself and ask yourself why you're doing that. And I think that's just be aware of don't just blindly go into conversations or if you're thinking to yourself, just blindly think to yourself, you know, I am right. You know, ask yourself, why am I right? Why does this make sense? Why does it, you know, we have to ask the same questions as the religious people who were trying to get to use skepticism. You know, it's no good telling them one thing and us doing another thing. You've got to ask yourself the same questions because we're all human beings and we're all prone to the same mistakes.
Mm. That is a great point and leads perfectly into our final question for the Q&A, which is speaking of common straw man arguments, what is the most common, or you can adjust it to be the most irritating or notable straw man argument that you have heard atheists use towards Christians?
Oh, God. I'm trying to think of the one that was, I had a great big argument the other week. It was funny because I was actually on vacation and I had a really intermittent internet access. And every time I went onto the internet, I just found myself replying to this same atheist guy who would kind of come up. I can't remember the argument he used. It was something along the lines of God can't be all knowing and something or other. I can't remember the details of it, but it was a total straw man of the Christian position. And the whole argument was like me saying, that's not the case. That's just not an argument. All you're doing is you're building this fantastic argument that you think's amazing, and it just doesn't work. But I don't know. There's so many where you could do it on almost any subject. If you decide to speak for somebody rather than listening to what they've got to say, then you can be pretty assured that at some stage you're going to strawman that person. You know, don't street speak for people. Ask them what they believe. Don't go to a Christian or a Muslim or a Hindu or a Buddhist and say, right, you guys believe this, and I have a problem with that. Mm-hmm. Ask them what they believe. And that's where the conversation starts, and that's how you avoid strawmanning someone. Ask them and listen to them. Listen to what they say. Because just because somebody is a Christian, it doesn't mean they've got the same opinion as the next Christian. So it's very, very easy to create a straw man against somebody by going in and saying, you believe this. Don't do that. That's wrong. That's very, very naughty. And I don't like it. Don't do it.
Oh, you say that in that voice. My goodness. Okay, moving on. Excellent. Excellent points for us this evening. And that is a great point to end on as well. I appreciate that perspective that you brought to us this week and turning it back on ourselves too and holding ourselves accountable to the same things that we expect from other people. It seems fair to me. And those were really wonderful points. So thank you for sharing that with us, Richard. That was fantastic. I am so glad we had you on this evening.
Recovering from Religion is a nonprofit organization whose mission it is to provide hope, healing, and support to those struggling with issues of doubt and non-belief. Hope, healing, and support is waiting for you on our website, recoveringfromreligion.org. There you can speak or chat with a trained agent who will work with you through your struggles and doubts or to help find resources that may work for you. You can also find local Recovering from Religion support groups in your area for the long-term recovery work. Resources specifically curated for those struggling with doubts, disbelief, and trauma can also be found on the RFR website. To connect with a secular therapist in your area, go to seculartherapy.org and create an account. If you'd like to support the work that RFR does, you can donate or sign up as a volunteer on the Recovering from Religion website. It's also a big help subscribing to the RFR YouTube channel, our blog, or following us on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram. Questions, comments, and suggestions can be emailed to us at rfrx@recoveringfromreligion.org. Thanks for tuning in, and we hope you'll be with us next time on the Recovering from Religion podcast.